The following lectures were given by Paul Marshall, April 18 through 19, 2008, in Bethesda, Maryland. Dr. Marshall is Senior Fellow of the Center for Religious Freedom, Hudson Institute, Washington, D.C. Dr. Marshall is the author and editor of over 20 books on religion and politics, especially religious freedom, including more recently, Religious Freedom in the World and Radical Islam's Rules, The Worldwide Spread of Extreme Sharia Law. This address is titled, Islam in the Modern World.
Last night, in the first presentation, we concentrated on theology, what the Muslims believe about Muhammad, about the Quran, about the Hadith, what are the core teachings in that. Then, in the second session, looked at Muslim history, Islamic history, particularly as it relates its relations with Christianity. In this third session, I'd like to talk about Islam in the modern world. What is the situation with Islam around the world? Let me open by looking at this map up here. This map shows a variety of countries, what percentage of the population is Muslim. Not how many Muslims there are, but given the number of people in that particular country, what percentage is Muslim. The darker the country, the darker the shading is on that map, the higher the percentage of Muslims. So you will notice the darker section, the one which would basically appear black on your map, those are countries which are 80 to 100% Muslim, though nowhere is actually 100%. Basically, you will notice that that concentration is in this area. In American sort of military or geostrategic terms, that's often the area we now call the Greater Middle East. So stretching from Morocco and Mauritania over here, across North Africa, through the Levant and into Turkey, the Arabian Peninsula, then Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and into Central Asia. That block, to which one might also add Bangladesh and then Indonesia, with extremely high concentrations of Muslims. So this is certainly the case if you're looking for Muslim concentrations, very much the heartland of Islam is here. If you remember from last night, particularly the Arab part here is the heartland in more than just concentration, but the Arabic itself is central to Islam. Remember that the standard belief is the Quran is not created. It is eternal, it is uncreated, it exists from the foundations of, can't really say the foundations of the world, because the world was created. But also it's in Arabic. So there is a sort of cultural privilege of Arabic, and therefore in practice of Arabs, within the Muslim world, a fact which is sometimes resented by many other Muslims. One drawback is that when we think of this, when we look at sort of the Greater Middle East or the Arab world, sometimes we have a tendency to confuse that with the Muslim world. It can be shown by this map, which I'll return to later. This is populations of Muslims in the world. The larger the circle, those circles are, the big circle is over 150 million. Okay, and the actual distributions of Muslims in the world is outside the Middle East or the greater Middle East. If there was such a person as a typical Muslim, they would not be living in a desert, either in Saudi Arabia or in Libya. Nor would they live in some of the massive cities of the Middle East, Cairo, Damascus, Baghdad. They've never seen a camel. She doesn't wear a burqa or even a hijab, which the basic head covering. Muslims are Malay people living in the Malay Peninsula down here, down through Singapore, or in Java, the central island of Indonesia, or Jakarta, or they lived in the steppes of Central Asia. through here, places like now Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and so forth. Or the largest single concentration here in South Asia, along the Indus and Ganges valleys. Go further west, you get to Iran, which is of course not Arab. It is Iranian or Persian. In fact, ethnically quite similar to white Europeans. The Turks are of course not Arab, and there's still a lot of ethnic tension between Turks and Arabs, because remember again from last night, the Turks, particularly in the form of the Ottoman Empire, ruled the Arab heartland for about 600 years. So there's tension there. And then one can look at Africa. Nigeria has between about 50 and 60 million Muslims, which may be more than there are Muslims in any Arab country. So in forests and savannas in Africa, in the steppes of Central Asia, in the valleys of India, in the jungles, and the cities of Southeast Asia. So let's talk about this a bit more. The world's largest Muslim country by population is Indonesia, string of islands here. Indonesia's total population now is about 240 million. Of them, about 80% are Muslim. With most of these statistics, I work with religion statistics all the time, so I always use the term more or less. You might be interested, it's very expensive, but that book just out, Religious Freedom in the World, gives a lot of these figures and estimates for religious population. It's certainly true that the Christian church in Indonesia has been growing very rapidly now for about 30 years. The usual estimates you'll see for Indonesia are 85 to 90% Muslim. It's certainly now lower than that. But still, it means you're dealing with 180 to 200 million Muslims in that one country. That's more than live in North Africa. After Indonesia, you get India. That's probably the second largest Muslim population in the world. Then Pakistan and Bangladesh. Each of these you're dealing with 150 to 170 million Muslims. So in what used to be sort of British India, which of course incorporated all of those, you have somewhat over half a billion Muslims. Or another way of putting that is almost half the world's Muslims live right there in South Asia. So if you wanted a typical Muslim, they're from the Indian subcontinent, population-wise. Another way of putting that, half the world's Muslims live east of Pakistan, not including Pakistan, they live there. Then in terms of large population centers, you have Iran, then you have Turkey, and then, only then, do you mean an Arab country. Egypt. Egypt's population now is about 76 million. The Christian population is sort of much disputed, but a figure of 8 to 10 million would be reasonable. So you're looking at about 65 million Muslims in Egypt. Then Nigeria, with maybe 55, and then a scattering of others. So ethnically, Muslims are not Arabs. So it's very important for us to understand the Muslim world, not to quickly make this transition between Arabs and Muslims. Arabs are about one-fifth of the world's Muslim population. Also important in the United States, not to make a quick transition between Arab and Muslim. For exactly the same reason, most of the Muslim populations of the United States are not Arabs. Probably the largest single ethnic group is probably African Americans within the U.S. After that, it's probably Iranians. Another thing to bear in mind in the U.S. is that most American Muslims are fairly secular. Again, take all these statistics with many pinches of salt, but probably two-thirds of American Muslims don't go near a mosque. The with the Iranian population, many of them fled. Either they were supported the Shah's regime or they fled after that. So if you took, if you talk to them or you talk to Muslims in the U.S. From other parts of the world about radical Islam or even Islam, often they'll say, not interested. I came to this country to get away from all that. Most Muslims in this country, and indeed in Europe and in many other parts of the world, are fairly secular or fairly nominal and really don't want to get into a lot of these questions. If we're talking about the United States, another thing to bear in mind is not only are most Muslims not Arab, most Arabs are not Muslims. Question of what constitutes an Arab can be much disputed. Many of the Christian populations in the Middle East sometimes affirm they are not Arabs. So if you take the example of Egypt, a Coptic Christian may just say, well, of course I'm an Arab, you know, I live in the Middle East, I speak Arabic. Others say, no, I'm not an Arab, I'm a Copt. I am descended from the original inhabitants of Egypt. If you're interested, by the way, the liturgical language of the Coptic Church in Egypt is the closest you're going to get to ancient Egyptian and the Pharaonic languages. It's a continuation of that. Also, with talking to Lebanese Christians of various kinds, I've occasionally had them very angry when I referred to them inadvertently as Arabs. We're not Arabs. Perhaps they might say we are Maronites or something else. Similarly, in Iraq now, the Chaldean and the Syrian Christian populations will often distinguish themselves from the Arabs. They say, I'm not. I am a Syrian. We are the original inhabitants of this land. So one has to be careful with talking, referring to people easily as Arabs. But if, in this context, if I just mean people whose original language was Arabic and come from this part of the world, that's all I mean. In the United States, of that population, now about 70% of those are Christian. It used to be about 90%. So people from the Middle East who come and settle in this country, a lot of Egyptians, a lot of Lebanese, now quite a few more Iraqis and so on, they're much more likely to be Christian. And very often we don't hear from them. They tend not to get politically organized in this country, and so their voice is drowned out. But that's also important to remember. So that gives us some brief overview of population and distribution. And again, when you think Islam, don't immediately think the Middle East, and don't immediately think Arabs. So the Muslim world is very varied. Some other divisions, about 85 to 90% of the Muslim world is Sunni. A bit later I'll get to what that means. Most of the other 10 to 15% are Shiite. Shiites tend to be concentrated, as I think we all know now, in Iran and, of course, over the border in Iraq. Those countries did not exist with their present boundaries till fairly recently, so essentially you have a concentration in that area. Also going down into the Persian Gulf, a lot of Shiites in Kuwait. Right here, if you go down to Bahrain and parts of the Arab Emirates and other places, again, large Shiite populations. Also large Shiite populations in the eastern part of Saudi Arabia, where they are quite heavily persecuted. The sort of official Saudi doctrine basically regards Shiites as heretics. So a concentration here, but also fairly large Shiite populations in Pakistan, also in India, also in Afghanistan with scatterings elsewhere, also down in Yemen and in Oman, which at one level is ruled by Shiites. So we will. I'll get back to that difference. But in terms of the geographical distinction, it's very important to see this variety. And generalizations are difficult, but I will make this generalization, that generally Asian Muslim populations, particularly as you go further east into Southeast Asia, with sort of Bangladesh, Malaysia, Indonesia, and so forth, are often quite a bit more syncretic or laid back about their Islam than people are in the Arab world. That doesn't mean they're not believing. If you wanted an analogy, you might think of Catholicism in Latin America. It takes on a lot of the sort of local folk aspects and so forth. So if you're in Indonesia, for example, much of Indonesia before it was Muslim was Hindu. And as you know, Hinduism has this great ability sort of to embrace everything. Some new religion comes in and Hindus say, oh, this is good, you'll be that religion, and then we'll all sit alongside each other. That element, cultural element, is strong in Indonesia. And you still have local village shrines or things of this kind. The villages make offerings to these every year. Most of the Muslims will do that. That can be fairly laid back. That's also true in Africa. There are exceptions to this, but as a general cultural pattern, that is true. One of the things about the sort of current Islamic revival, if you can call it that, is that a lot of the radicalization you see taking place in the Muslim world is becoming, by and large, more radical under the influence of the Iranians and the Saudis and other movements, is that some of the Arab movements look at these other Muslims throughout the world and say, well, they're not really Muslims. It'd be like strict Presbyterians or Baptists going off to Guatemala and seeing, you know, some all these ceremonies going on, and then everybody has a ceremony, and they take the Virgin Mary through the village, and there's all sorts of other statues, and who are all these other people? Then you all go out and get drunk in the evening. Let's say, this is not Christianity. We really have to bring them back to that. The reaction of, say, Saudis, Wahhabis in Africa, large parts of Asia, is like that. It says, this is not real Islam. You're bad Muslims. We've got to get them into shape. And getting them into shape means we have to make them like us. In terms of, and the Saudis have a particularly rigid and reactionary form of Islam, they are evangelizing, to use that term, madly throughout the world. Saudi Arabia currently spends about $3 billion a year exporting its version of Islam. It pays, builds mosques, and the mosques look like they do in Saudi Arabia. Go to the Balkans now. Traditional Balkan mosques were sort of very Turkish, almost Byzantine. Lots of ornamentations, stained glass windows, all these sorts of things. For the Saudi, I'm using not just the Saudis, you get these movements out of Yemen, the Muslim Brotherhood does these things out of Egypt and so on. But if they build a mosque, it's going to be one of these white austere things, getting rid of all what they regard as the idolatry. And you pay the imams. In these poor areas, the imams are often not educated, so give them a scholarship. Send them off to Riyadh or Mecca for a year and teach them. You give funding for students. You produce copies of the Quran. You teach people Arabic. You provide them free books. You provide them free tapes. You provide them free videotapes. You offer scholarships. You say to the local imam, oh, you know, come and give a lecture in Saudi Arabia and we'll pay you $25,000, you know, which is 10 years' salary. So one sees this sort of takeover throughout the world. And just to give you some perspective on that, with that $3 billion, took that figure, by the way, from testimony from Treasury Department officials before Congress 3 weeks ago. At the height of its power, the Soviet Union spent $1 billion per year on sort of ideological warfare. I mean, they may have been funding military and other stuff, but simply Comintern activities of trying to promote communism and Russian and other influence, that was about $1 billion a year in current dollars. Saudis are spending $3 billion a year. So, straight from our gas tank to, I mean, it's true. We are helping to, not sure what we can do about it, but we are helping to fund the radicalization of Islam, which is taking place throughout the world. But again, let's look at some more theological differences. I mentioned last night there are about 1.2, 1.3 billion Muslims in the world. Also mentioned the sort of commonly agreed five pillars of Islam, and then sort of six basic Muslim beliefs. Those would be common to pretty well every Muslim throughout the world. Other than that, there's a great variety, and there are probably, the highest estimate I've seen is from Sheikh Kabani, who maintains that there are 432 schools of Islam in the world. My reply was, that's nothing. We have about 25,000 varieties of Pentecostals in the world. But that was yesterday. There'll be more of them now. So that there are a variety of schools, varieties of schools within schools, particularly the Shiites have a bewildering variety. But if in larger terms, if you wanted to use terms similar to Protestant, Catholic, Orthodox, and so on, theologically there are basically three types of Muslims in the world. You have the Sunni Shiite division, and then a third one, which is Sufism, which isn't so much a separate pillar alongside those, but a tendency within Islam, which you will get within the Sunnis and within the Shia. It would be like, an analogy again in Christian terms would be, say you want to distinguish Protestants and Catholics, and then you want to use a third category, which is Charismatics. Well, of course, you can be a Charismatic Protestant and a Charismatic Catholic. The same way one could be a Sufi Sunni and a Sufi Shiite. So, not three pillars, but a way of dividing that up. The Sunni, as I said, about 85% of the world's Muslims, reflects a dedication to the Sunnah, the beliefs and practices of Islam, modeled by the first prophet. What is the origin of the difference between Sunni and Shiite was about who would be the successor to Muhammad. When Muhammad dies, there was sort of no clear principles laid down to what do we do now? I mean, who's running this show? Should it be one person? Should it be a group of persons? If it's one person, how do we pick that person? There are various views. Various people thought it should be, it's a successor to Muhammad, should be in the family. So they said it should be a member of the Prophet's family. And the preferred candidate was Ali, who was the Prophet's son-in-law and also a cousin. There was a party which suggested it should be Ali. They lost out. The larger group says, the Muslim community should pick the person who seems to be most fitting and appoint them. So the successor, Muhammad, the first one picked, was Abu Bakr, who happened to be also an uncle of Muhammad, but was picked largely as a senior figure, one that certainly knew Muhammad well, and knew what he thought, knew what he wanted, and was senior, one of the earliest people in the Muslim community, and a person who was pious. So they were chosen by consensus, rather than by being related to the Prophet per se. And this was followed for the next two caliphs, Umar, then Uthman, and then the fourth caliph was Ali. Again, chosen by the majority, not because he was in the Prophet's family per se, but he was the most suitable candidate. So in Ali, both these two divisions about how you decide who the successor is, well, Ali scored well on both counts. So he was picked. But there was sort of great opposition, division. Remember this period when we drew the map, you know, at this point the Muslim Arabs have expanded, taken over the Levant, they're moving into Iran at this point, but certainly have this area. Northern Arabia, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, to use the modern names. There were fights between proponents of Uthman, the family now called the Umayyads, his son and others, those who were partial to Ali. So a civil war broke out. The party who supported Ali was the party of Ali, Shia Ali, the party of. So they were shorthand called Shiites. Shiite just means the party of Ali. Anyway, there was war. Ali was killed. For the Shiites, they believed that Ali was the true caliph, and therefore his son, Hussein, should take over. And so there were further battles, and then Hussein was killed. And this took place in what is now Iraq. And you will have seen on the television many millions of Shiites marching in Iraq in the ceremony known as Ashura. This commemorates the death of Hussein. And Ali and Hussein, important sites of their life, are in what is now Iraq, and their tombs are there. So those cities which you've now heard of, Najaf, Karbala, these are sites of the tombs of those whom the Shiites believe were the right caliphs, and also that they were martyrs, that they were particularly pious and holy. So not just the political leader, for the Sunnis would like their leaders to be holy too, but the caliph was sort of the guardian of the Muslim country, not of the Muslims, more a political military term. They weren't necessarily the wisest or the great teachers, they weren't necessary. But within the Shiites, it was very much that Ali and Hussein were very much saints and saintly and peace-loving, and they are remembered. So with the death of Ali, with the death of Hussein, and all this is taking place about 30 years after the death of Muhammad, you get this split. So at one level, you could call this, say, a political division, who gets to take over. But over a theological point as to who is the proper successor of the prophet. But even if you call it a political split, if a religious group splits for political reasons, and it carries on for 1,300 years, the evolution gets very different. With the Sunnis, there is less stress on the prophet's family, and much more on the question of right, correct doctrine, the Sunnah, the way of the prophet. And in principle, who is the leader of the Muslims? In principle, they're meant to be chosen within a council. Many Muslims point to this as a democratic element, choosing the new successor. Anyway, this didn't last long, that what happened is with the caliphs we now call the Umayyads. You know, why do they have a family name? Because they're a family. When one died, their son took over, and so on. So very quickly, this ideal of the Muslim community chooses the leader meant that basically the leader chooses the leader. And lo and behold, they say, you know, who is the best candidate? Why? You know, it's the little Saeed, my son. He just seems to be the perfect person. And his. And then the other conflicts and the Abbasids took in. So under the Sunnis, it turned into a type of monarchy, to some degree with the Shiites too. But the Shiites trace the ones they look to as a leader is again now in the family of Muhammad, Ali, Hussein, and down. And these are the true caliphs. So after the first four leaders, the Shiites have a whole different tradition of who was the true ruler and teacher of the Muslims, and it went down through the family. The majority of Shia, you may have heard these terms like a 12er Shia, or a 7er Shia, or a 9er Shia. What this believes is how many of these original rulers you think were good, and when did the whole thing go off the rails? So the dominant position is the 12er Shia, That is, the first 12 imams were good and righteous and holy, and you should follow that example. After that, it went off the rails. And again, with 12 Shiites, the idea is that the 12th of these imams, the leaders, one day disappeared. And the belief is that he went into what's called occultation. It's a word only used in this context, so to speak, not so much in heaven, but in a reserved place, waiting, and will return. And this is the hidden imam, of which you may have read. The current president of Iran, Ahmadinejad, is very, very big on this. In principle, all Iranian Shiites should believe it, and many of them will, but some people just really get into it. You know, similarly, all Christians do or should believe in the Holy Spirit, but for some that's much more central and significant than for others. There are grounds for thinking that Ahmadinejad really thinks the 12th Imam is going to come back soon and is waiting for that, maybe wanting to hurry him up by having a nuclear war or something. So there's a very apocalyptic, eschatological element which you get amongst the Shiites. There are other groups, as I said, the Selvas and the Seveners and the Niners and so on. The Ismailis, if you remember the Aga Khan, are an earlier offshoot of Shiism. Groups of this kind ruled Egypt for quite a few centuries and still rule in Yemen. Another thing with the Shiites is because of this, their particular clergy, if we use that term, are much more central and understood to be holy. And particularly descent from the Prophet is very important. Not necessarily that you be the Caliph, but if you see an Iranian wearing a black head covering, that means they're a descendant of the Prophet, linearly. That's important for Sunnis too, I mean, something to be proud of. But for the Shiites, it's much more central. And so these leaders, the head should also not just be the supernal ruler, keeping peace and protecting the Muslim community, but is themselves a spiritual leader of spiritual power. So those are some of the formal distinctions between Sunnis and Shiites. If one wanted to do a Christian parallel, again, that's always dangerous of how would we conceive of those in Christian terms. The nearest thing I could think of would be this. The Sunnis are more like Presbyterians. The Shia are more like Pentecostals. That breaks down almost immediately. But if you wanted just one quick image, it tends to be more like that. Shia, much more devotional. You will have seen that people whipping themselves in the Ashura ceremonies in remembrance of Hussein and so on. Whereas the Sunnis, much more correct doctrine, following the laws, establishing what the rules are, so very scholarly element. So often it produces very different cultural styles. The attitudes of Shia and Sunni to each other vary. Shia can be looked at with suspicion by or worry by many Sunnis, in the same way a Presbyterian might look with some suspicion on strong charismatics. At the extreme, there are Sunni schools which just regard the Shia as heretics. That's a very common opinion in Saudi Arabia. And as I mentioned, the Shia in Saudi Arabia are severely repressed. So I'd look down on. You might have noticed, if you remember, Abu Zakawi, he was the leader he was killed last year, leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. In February of last year, I think it was last year, the year before, the U.S. military intercepted a letter to Abu Zakawi from Zawahiri, off with bin Laden, and then also intercepted a letter from Zakawi. Zakawi is originally from Jordan, but he was heading Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Anyway, there's this 21-page diatribe by Zarqawi. He's a Sunni. He's from Jordan. He's heading al-Qaeda in Iraq. They're mainly interested in the military and other aspects of this, so most of the newspapers didn't comment on what most of the letter was about. I printed out the letter, you know, from the internet. Comes out at 21 pages. Okay, 12 of those pages are simply a venomous attack on Shiites. I mean, he talks about the Americans. He talks, you know, the Americans get three, were bad for three pages, other things like this. The majority of the letter is about Shiites. And Zarqawi says, they are worse than the Jews. Which, you know, in Zarqawi's hierarchy is, you know, got to be pretty low. And that they must be killed. That meant that in Iraq, the attacks by al-Qaeda in Iraq against the Shiites, that was for political tactical reasons. Let's attack the Shiites will attack us, we'll start this tension and the civil war, and we can win. So it was certainly a calculated thing. But more than that, particularly for Zarqawi, Shiites are heretics. They've got to be killed. The letter from Zawahiri, I hope you can follow these names, though they both begin with a Z, al-Zawahiri, reputed to be Osama bin Laden's deputy. His letter to Zarqawi after this was said a few things, but the basics is, could you like lay off the Shia for a while? We've got Americans to deal with, we've got all these other sorts of things, and this plan to exterminate the Shiites, this is not a very good time for doing this. It wasn't clear whether Zawahiri said it's not good to exterminate the Shiites, or whether he was saying this is not a good time to do it. He was fairly ambiguous on that score. So you can get, at some level in the extremes, you can get sort of vicious, murderous, literally murderous animosity. In other cases, it's just that other group, they're weird. There's all these sorts of tensions. In Pakistan, you're getting a lot of violent conflict between Sunnis and Shiite groups. That's Sunni, Shiite. The third group, Sufis, these are basically Muslims who emphasize the spiritual, devotional, experiential side of Islam. Very much a question of personal piety and experience. And as I say, you can have Shiite and Sunni Sufis, though most would be Sunni simply because most Muslims are Sunni. Sufis are not necessarily peaceful. They can actually be quite powerful and violent. But it's very much on the experience of piety. So the Sufis I know, their reaction to someone like bin Laden or the Saudis and so on would be, and is, saying, these guys, you know, you read what they say. You know, it's all about war, fighting, and stuff like this. Or it's rules. For them, Islam is a series of rules. Muhammad said, you should do this, that, and the other. So what do? You do this, that, and the other. And that's it. He says, but with them, he says, you know, they don't seem to spend their time talking about prayer. And if you remember the five pillars of Islam, you know, belief in the one God, that Muhammad is his prophet, then prayer and almsgiving, celebrating Ramadan, going on the Hajj. So he said, they don't seem to talk about that very much. And these are, in fact, the five pillars. Sufis are also often organized in brotherhoods. They form networks. They have houses, you could almost think like the Masons in this respect, separate from the mosque where people gather together. And these are international networks, which are often not publicly known. Just to mention, these are also important features in Iraq, which have been neglected by the U.S. government and the U.S. media. By the way, just to mention, I have a book coming out in October, November, on religion and the media, which is a series of case studies. One of them is on media coverage in Iraq, not on the military stuff, but on the religious stuff. Of course, those overlap. Just why the U.S. government didn't really understand the country. Believe me, the media accounts don't understand the country. They still don't. So you get, emphasizing the Sunni-Shiite divisions, well, there are Sufi brotherhoods and lodges right throughout Iraq. Okay. And they include Sunni and Shiites. There they get together for teaching the Muslim equivalent of prayer and Bible study. Those go on all over the place. This is also an important and often neglected dimension of what's going on in the Muslim world. Much Muslim art, particularly poetry, one finds in Sufi circles. Also, you probably will have read around all these controversies of cartoons that Muslims do not believe in portraying. You can't have a visual representation of Muhammad. This is simply not true. That's a majority Muslim view. Go to the Met in New York. They got tons of Afghan and other portraits of Muhammad, and the Turks did it, and the Iranians did it, and the Sufis did it, and so on. One should not emphasize the sort of religious ecumenism of Sufis and think they're all sort of peace and love type people. That's not the case. Generally, Sufis are much more open to people of other religions. One person I know who's one of the senior Sufi figures in the United States, Sheikh Hisham Kabbani, it would be his view that as a Muslim, he would see no reason why Christians or Jews would need to become Muslims. He says that God has given you your revelation, you should seek to follow that. Some of the Sufi poets and others, this is from Ibn Arabi, but there are others, Rumi and others, who said things like this, just one quotation from some Sufi poetry from Ibn Arabi, 12th century in Spain. "Before today, I used to reject my fellow beings if they did not profess the same religion as I. Now my heart has become receptive to every image. It is a meadow for the grazing deer, a monastery for the monk, a temple for idols, a Kaaba for the pilgrim, Torah scrolls and a copy of the Quran. I profess the religion of love wherever my caravan may turn to. Love is my law and my faith." So this is also a particular dimension of Islam. There are also other cross-cutting movements. I mentioned before that in terms of the conflict within the Muslim world, one is seeing increasing radicalization. Movements like the Muslim Brotherhood, movements like the Saudis, I'll return to these in the final lecture. But one should also note that one reason that more radical Islam is growing in influence throughout the world is not just that it's got tons of money and organization behind it, but that many of the Muslims who oppose it get intimidated or outright killed. Give a couple of examples. Naguib Mahfouz, who recently died, is the only Arab winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. Many of his books, most of his books, were banned in Egypt. And in, I think it was 1991, he was stabbed by a militant and partially paralyzed because of his writings. Other Egyptian writers of a similar view just stopped writing. It's simply too dangerous. You will find now, if you're interested in interesting sort of literature, novels, and other things in the Muslim world, you can often find them in Beirut. They're allowed to be sold. You can't buy them anywhere else. But people buy them in Beirut and you get them on the internet. But you find many of these books have no name on them, no author listed. Too dangerous. There are quite a few interesting Saudi novelists, but they can't put their name on their books. And the books are published in Beirut and then, so to speak, smuggled back. Let me just quote from a book, The Children of Abraham, by Khalid Duran. I'll make some comments on him later. Duran has himself been persecuted since. But he gives a list, and I could expand on that list. I'm writing a book about this too. But he says, the Algerian humanitarian lawyer, Ali Machili, assassinated in Paris in 1987. The Afghan resistance leader, Professor Qayyum Rabah, assassinated in Peshawar in 1990. The Iranian human rights activist, Kazim Rajawi, assassinated Geneva in 1990. The Palestinian politician Issam As-Sattawi, assassinated in Lisbon in 1990. The list goes on and very much. So that there is within Islam repression, often by the most violent means, of voices which oppose this radicalization. And let me just close with one other example of this, Khalid Duran. Duran is a Muslim who lives not 2 miles away from where we are now. Wrote the book, The Children of Abraham, at the request of the American Jewish Committee. And it was written as an introduction to Islam for American Jews, a companion volume to a book on an introduction to Judaism for Muslims, written by Dr. Reuven Firestone. This book came out in 2001. Duran's book was not an attack on Islam. He was trying to explain Islam to other people. I think some of the offense was he was cooperating with Jews in producing this book. Nevertheless, a Jordanian imam, Abu Zant, who almost certainly had never read the book, because it was 1 week after it came out and it was in English and Abu Zant did not speak English, denounced this book as heretical and issued a fatwa against Khalid Duran, who shortly thereafter had a stroke and now really cannot work. Khalid is in his 70s, people have strokes, but I would say a fatwa calling for your death is likely to be a factor in your having a stroke. So if you just take that as a small example, but a Muslim who lives fairly close by for his work has suffered. So that also now in the Muslim world, one sees tremendous tensions and conflicts. And I'm always like to say that in terms of the battle of ideas, one should not think or not just think of sort of a conflict between, say, the West or Christianity and the Muslim world. In many ways, the most crucial conflict of ideas, battle of ideas, or war of ideas, is the one currently taking place within Islam. It's very polarized and it's very difficult.
The proceeding was a presentation.